again, and welcome to the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. This week, we again turn our eyes to the Americas, looking back on the Americas Division 1 T20 Championship and forward to the last hurdle before the World Cup qualifiers, the World Cricket League Division 3 in Bermuda. To do so, I have with me, as always, Andrew Nissen. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
And a welcome return for our show's first guest, he's King Cricinfo and Dream Cricket's Peter Deltan. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, guys, for having me on.
So, always a pleasure, Peter. Let's start with America's Division 1. It was a great week for the USA at the tournament. They played 8 games. They had 8 fairly convincing wins.
No, it was hard to find any faults with the way they played for the most part. I mean, there were some issues with the fielding here and there in terms of the catching and some of the ground fielding. And overall, there could be some things that could be improved with that, and that's always been one of the problems that USA Cricket has struggled with. But overall, I think it was a very dominant performance. I mean, even putting aside the fact that Canada wasn't there, the US team looked like they were a much better outfit than the team that competed in the same tournament 2 years prior. It was much younger squad. There was a lot more energy out there on the field. And I think it's also a much better indicator of the true talent of the teams because the pitch has been playing a lot better. I mean, 2 years ago at the same tournament in Florida, the pitch was the way it had been playing since the stadium had been opened. The pitch was pretty wretched in terms of the ball coming onto the bat and teams being able to post decent scores and bowlers being able to get any kind of proper assistance out of the pitch in terms of bounce and pace. And the groundsman down there has really done a tremendous job fixing that wicket over the last 12 to 18 months. And it certainly is showing now, and you know, I think the first indication that things were turning around in that regard was for the West Indies, New Zealand 2020s last summer. And I think after the first series of full member matches that took place between New Zealand and Sri Lanka back in 2010, a lot of people were shocked to see the improvement in the way it was playing. And I think the highest score back 2 years ago in this tournament, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I would imagine it would have been somewhere in the 150 range. And this past week, I mean, there were plenty of scores in the 180s and the 190s, and the USA put up a record score for them in T20 cricket, making 198 for one against the Cayman Islands on the final day of the tournament. So, you know, it made for better cricket, at least watching from the stands. And you saw it gave the opportunity for a lot of players to shine. First and foremost, at the top of their list for the USA was Stephen Taylor, scoring 2 centuries, one inside the stadium and one at Brian Piccolo Park, about 20 minutes away. And then he should have scored another century inside the stadium in the first match against Cayman Islands. It was tried to bring it up with a 6 and got caught for 95, but there was, from Stephen Taylor, just some incredible batting over the course of the 8 games. And Gennaro Tucker as well was very impressive for Bermuda, and he wound up coming away with the tournament MVP.
Yeah, I was going to mention Stephen Taylor because you mentioned there's quite a few young players in the side. He's really come along in the last, I guess, 12 months for the USA, and is probably far and away your best batsman now, I would think.
I had a brief conversation after the conclusion of the 2020 tournament with USA coach Tiru Kumaran, and he asked, one of the things he was asking was, you know, what's the difference? What did I think the difference was between this side and the side that competed in the World 2020 qualifier back in Dubai last year? And I said the number one difference is that Stephen Taylor is a year older. I mean, the remarkable amount of development he's shown and maturation process he's shown in the last 12 months, it's really done wonders for the U.S. national team as a whole to have somebody like him come through and just be a one-man wrecking crew with the bat. And he's just got that added dimension, that X factor that is really hard to come by. And having him as an asset instantly makes USA a lot more competitive heading into the 2020-16 team qualifier in the UAE later this year.
The other side's there. Bermuda, a team that has done quite well in the past, in quite the recent past, but they seem to struggle a bit in this. They had a loss to Suriname and another really close match, which they were probably lucky to get away with because Tucker smashed 65 off 30 balls at the finish to get them over the line. Are they struggling?
Yeah, I think he hit five sixes off five straight balls, two in the 18th over and two in the 19th over, something like that, three in the 19th over to win the match. Yeah, but if you watched Suriname and you watched Bermuda across the course of the tournament, you would definitely say that Suriname is a team that's on the rise and Bermuda is a team that's on the decline. Bermuda's obviously been declining since for the last 5 or 6 years, ever since the 2007 World Cup, but I think that decline is in some ways accelerating in the last year or two, and they had a very poor finish at the World 2020 qualifier last year. And here again in the Americas, you could always count on basically USA, Canada, and Bermuda to be the cream of the crop, and there was a big gap between those three and the next set of, I guess, second-tier teams within the Americas. But Suriname is definitely closing that gap. I remember the previous ICC regional development manager for the Americas, Martin Vieira, back in 2011 when Suriname was competing at that tournament. He had made a visit. They had held some sort of regional meeting in Suriname, and he had gone down there, I don't know, maybe separately from that, and to give a, it was kind of like, I think, a certification visit because Suriname was applying to go from affiliate to associate status, which they received. And as part of the visit, they were going around to different facilities in different areas, and there was apparently just for that, for the visit by Martin Vieira and I believe Tim Anderson, the global development manager from the ICC, they went into some ground just to watch some sort of practice match, and there was allegedly 10,000 people who showed up just to watch some local match, and it was clear that the interest level and the playing numbers were pretty sizable for an emerging country like that. And Martin said at the time, 2 years ago, watch out, you know, they might not look like it now on the field. I mean, Suriname got whooped around pretty badly, but in 2011, but, and I mean, if you go back to 2008, Suriname was the team that Sichel Nadkarni scored 197 against in a 50 over match for the USA. But so they may not look like it now, but just you wait and see. In 5 to 10 years time, they will be one of the strongest teams in the region, if not ascending all the way to become, you know, what, the top team in the region. And I think people who were there may have shook their heads at the time and said, and just nodded politely, okay. But you look at Suriname on the field, and they've got some genuine promise. And this is a team that had, I think, 5 or 6 of their first-choice players were not able to come to the U.S., because of visa issues. And just imagine what they could have done with a first choice 11 or a first choice 14 main squad if that was how they performed with the players that they had at their disposal. So there's some encouraging signs there for Suriname. Conversely, Bermuda, they're really, really struggling, and they look like a team that by the time the next America's qualifier is played in 2015, Suriname could definitely pose a serious threat to their status is, you can always, heading into these qualifiers, if there's two spots at stake and Canada itself is already automatically qualified, you could always chalk up the US and Bermuda to take those two spots in the Americas. I don't think that's a certainty anymore.
Are there any particular players at Suriname that you think we should be keeping an eye out then, the particularly young ones?
I think, well, their top player at this tournament anyway was Saeed Dreepal, who bowled left-arm spin, and I believe he was their top run scorer as well in the tournament. And basically, when he was out there in the middle and he was performing, Suriname always had a chance to be in the match, and he was their big wicket. And basically, he was the reason why Bermuda was able to beat Suriname in the first matchup. I mean, when he was at the crease, I can't remember exactly, but I believe Suriname was 80 for 2. I think they were, 80 for 2 or 80 for 1 after 9 overs or 10 overs, and they only wound up with about 135 or 140 that first matchup, and they should have, that was poor, and they should have finished up with no less than 150 and probably should have made it somewhere close to 160. And it was when he got out that the innings kind of tapered off. And if he was able to stay out there for just 5 more overs, and they put up that 150, 155, they would have won that game. They would have won that game easily because Bermuda was really struggling in that chase. And, they wound up beating them in the second game. And if they hadn't, Suriname also tripped up against Bahamas in the tournament, and if they hadn't stumbled in one of the two matches they played against Bahamas, conceivably they could have gone into that final match against Bermuda with a spot in the top two at stake, and it would have come down to net run rate, and I think Bermuda might still have pulled it out, but it definitely would have made it a lot more interesting and a lot more compelling on that final day. And if they can get some more players to compliment him and be a strong nucleus, then again, Suriname is a team that could definitely raise some eyebrows over the next few years.
It's definitely a positive sign in a region that's probably struggled a little bit globally. Thoughts on Bahamas and the Cayman Islands? Cayman Islands got relegated in the end.
I was a bit surprised. I think a lot of people were, but because they do have some talented players. I think one of the players who's been fairly good for them over the last couple of years in terms of young promising talent is Kervin Ebanks, bowls medium pace and comes in, and that's in the middle order. And they've got a few other guys who are kind of handy, but you looked at them in the field and they had some pretty unfit players, and it didn't appear that the level of commitment and seriousness in terms of training and the approach to the tournament was as strong as a team who's a lot hungrier than them, like Suriname was. And I think maybe they took their place for granted a little bit, and they just assumed they weren't going to compete with USA and Bermuda, but they were at least going to be secure in the knowledge that they would finish either third or fourth, and they would maintain their place in Division One. And as the week went along, they just kind of got worse and worse, and the momentum just kept going. And when they lost to Bahamas, it was this is no joke. We've got to get our act together here, and they just couldn't recover to get things going in the right direction in time. And I don't think they're as in bad a situation as Argentina is, because Argentina's playing numbers are so severely low compared to just about everybody else in the region. If you look at the ICC data relating to Argentina, but Cayman Islands, I think this is a wake-up call for them. Bahamas, they do have a couple good players who can bad. I mean, the Sailors are not bad, and they had another player, Ryan Tappan, who was like, he was somewhat promising. My favorite player on Bahamas is Turin Brown. Turin Brown, I remember seeing him for the first time back in 2009 at the ICC America's Under 19 tournament, and he was only, I think, 14 at the time. And he was this little kid, and the USA played against him, and the USA just steamrolled Bahamas in that Under 19 tournament. But Turin was the rock for them. He was the only player who showed any spine at the crease, and he was the, I think, the youngest player on the team at the time, and he earned the USA players' respect. I mean, at the end of the match, when they came off the field, and I think in the team hotel during the week, the USA players were always having a chat with Turin, and they all liked him. He was a likable guy. And he comes in this week, and he's only 18, and he was fearless. I mean, he hit Elmore Hutchinson's big left-arm fastball for the U.S. He hit him for two massive sixes. And Turin, he's a small guy. He's only maybe 5'1", 5'2". But, I mean, he's built like a bowling ball. I mean, he's a strong kid. And, he was batting in the middle order for Bahamas in this tournament. But I think in a few years he could be somebody who should definitely be moving up the order as he gets more experience. And I think you can get a few more players who've got the kind of energy and the kind of skills that Turin Brown does. I think that would be something that would give Bahamas a little bit more hope and make them more competitive. But he's definitely a shining light for them.
It does actually appear that second tier has actually become quite competitive too. Obviously with Argentina in the lower division, the Cayman Islands in the lower division, they're going to have to keep fighting to stay up, these teams, as these tournaments roll around.
Yeah, again, I mean, Argentina was a team that I think for a long, long time they took for granted their spot in the top tier, and over the last four years or so, they've had that just incredible losing streak in World Cricket League tournaments, and that's kind of sapped maybe some of their morale in terms of their regional competitiveness within the Americas. And now you've got Cayman Islands going down. So there's been, you know, a bit of a shakeup. There's in terms of that kind of those fringe teams between the first and second tier. They've been put on notice. I mean, Bahamas went down in 2010, and it was Suriname who came back up in 2011, and Argentina went down. Now Bahamas is back up, and it's Cayman Islands who's gone back down. So the status quo isn't there anymore, and you know, there's been some shifting around, and it's put everybody on notice in that kind of second tier. And like I said, again, you have Suriname, who's not standing still. They're showing tremendous signs of progress, and it's definitely put a team like Bermuda on notice. I don't think USA or Canada has to worry so much as of yet, but Bermuda, if, again, they don't get their act together fairly soon, Suriname could sneak up on them, and before you know it, Bermuda could be, you know, within the space of a decade, they could be a team that has gone from competing in an ICC World Cup to a team that can't even make the global qualifier for the World Cup or World 2020 events.
It's quite similar to what's happened to some extent in Europe and in Asia, where the sort of longer-term associate members of the ICC have tended to decline. And certainly in Europe, Gibraltar and Israel used to have quite a high position within Europe, and they've declined in recent years, with Guernsey, Jersey, and to some extent Norway surpassing them. And similar things have happened in Asia, with Singapore, were often one of the top Asian sides, and have now sort of dropped down the rankings in Asia. So it's a common feature in regional tournaments these days.
And it's something that I know what Andrew's opinions are on this, but I mean, that's how it should be. It should be a merit-based thing. It shouldn't be that Gibraltar or Israel 10 or 20 years ago, when they were competing in the ICC trophy, they could always be safe in the knowledge that no matter how bad they were 20 years from now, they could always be guaranteed a spot in the ICC trophy or now the World Cup qualifier. It should be merit-based, and I think it's fantastic that that's how it's structured in the associate system in terms of promotion and relegation between World Cup League and also at the regional level within the Division One, Division Two in the Americas or Europe or Asia. And I think it's just a shame that that kind of that the value in that structure isn't applied to the full members, but that's another story for another day, I guess.
Let's move forward a week, because following that tournament, there was a one-day series organized against Bermuda for the USA. It was 2-1, the result. Who performed well in that, and was that a good guide to where you think the two teams are, or are there a lot of players missing and injured?
I think in terms of where Bermuda is, it was a very good guide, because if you observed them on the field, they looked like a team that was very disinterested, very lethargic, didn't really want to be there, and they looked like a team that was without much motivation, and if you ask me, they look like a team that is going to be fighting a relegation battle in Division 3 rather than a promotion battle. I think, a couple of people were commenting down there in Florida that so often the fixtures that are organized kind of at this level, especially at the sub-high performance program level, the fixtures that are organized are the bare minimum. The only games that USA or Suriname or Bermuda or whoever is in the region will be playing are the only ones mandated by the ICC or the ICC Americas. So basically the only fixtures they're going to be playing for the course of a two-year period are the ICC Americas Division 2 or Division 1, whatever division they're in. And if they manage to happen to qualify for a global qualifier or if they're, depending on what division they're in the World Cricket League, that's it. They don't organize separate bilateral structures outside of that to kind of gauge with a standard to try and help improve development or give players an opportunity to develop or put them in a competitive atmosphere. And here was a rare opportunity where that happened. And it seems like Bermuda was not really enthusiastic about it, didn't really look like they wanted to be there. And, I mean, a really good example of that was Malachi Jones. Malachi Jones, back in 2007, he was the guy who was the bowler who, everybody remembers Dwayne Lebrock taking that remarkable slip catch one-handed, leaping across to his right like a salmon. But I think a lot of people forget it was Malachi Jones who was the bowler who took that wicket, and he was only a teenager at the time. And I think there was so much promise for him coming out of that tournament. And in the last couple of years, I don't know what's happened. I remember reading a report a year or two ago that Jeffrey Boycott made a visit to Bermuda, and he was interested in giving a trial to Jones at Yorkshire and wanted to meet with Jones, and Jones blew him off. He showed up at whatever ground was in they were supposed to meet at in Bermuda. There was supposed to be some sort of game going on, and Jones decided he had better things to do that day. And Boycott came out in the Bermuda press and said he was pretty disappointed. And hey, if the kid doesn't want to have a trial at Yorkshire, then so be it. And you saw him in these matches, and he's somebody who, if he's taking the game seriously, he bowls off of a whatever 15 or 20 stride run up, coming in bowling medium pace. And in these 50 over matches, he was bowling medium pace off about two or three strides, and he was not looking. He wasn't looking to really put a whole lot of energy, put a whole lot of effort into what he was trying to accomplish out there, and that kind of set the tone for the rest of the squad. The player probably who had the most energy and the team, and the most enthusiasm was Delray Rollins. You've got this 15-year-old left-arm spinner who's looking to impress at every opportunity, and yeah, he brought some vibrancy to the team, but outside of him, the team looks very, like I said, lethargic. Didn't really look like they were too interested in playing, and the USA beat them down pretty badly those first two games. And in the third game, the USA rested Mohammed Gauss, and they rested Elmore Hutchinson, who were two of their first-choice bowlers. And if those two had been playing in the third game, I think USA would have won that game pretty handily. The signs were not good for Bermuda coming out of those three matches heading into the Division III tournament that begins later this month. And I think you will see them, like I said, fighting a relegation battle with Oman and Uganda. And it'll be a three-dog fight for the top two between USA, Italy, and Nepal for a chance to move up into the World Cup qualifier next year in New Zealand.
We're definitely seeing a defensive response too. The Bermuda press was quite negative about their performance, and Stephen Average, their captain, I think yesterday came out and said that the true believers will have faith in their team and things will go well, and then he's not interested in the negativeness. So they're obviously a little bit under the pump from home about how they perform.
Well, that kind of relationship is always, at least from what I've observed in the last couple of years, it's been pretty combative between the players and the press. I think there's a lot of frustration built up because of what they achieved in going to the 2007 World Cup and qualifying for that event, and seeing where they are now, it doesn't augur well for their future. I mean, it's kind of confusing in some regards, because in the Americas, when you have these ICC Global Development Awards that are handed out every year, in the Americas region, Bermuda has cleaned house in terms of the development, and I think in particular the junior development initiatives over the last several years. I mean, they've always come out winning way more awards than the USA or Canada, as far as I know. And in particular, they're always getting plaudits from the judging panels for their junior development and grassroots initiatives, but it's not really evident in their on-field products. I mean, you could say that, you know, maybe this wasn't a full-strength squad because the two of the key players who were missing were Josh Gilbert, who's I believe he's still a teenager. You think he would be 18 or 19 right now, maybe have just turned 20, but the off spinner who's been a young promising talent for them over the last 4 or 5 years, and then also Kamal Leverock, who's Dwayne Leverock's nephew. He's a promising young all rounder and came up through Bermuda under 19s, and I think he's either 18 or 19 right now. And they both missed the tournament because they were going, I think they had school exams at the time, so they couldn't come to Florida. But, you know, Kamal bowls medium pace. He's a pretty decent batsman as well. In terms of youth coming through, those two and then Delray Rollins are probably the three most promising youth prospects. But, I don't think if those two were there, they would have really changed the fortunes significantly of the team overall. I think, again, there's definitely some signs that would lead you to be very concerned if you're a Bermuda cricket supporter. If I were, a Bermuda fan, I'd be pretty worried about their chances of success in Division III. And the one thing they do have going for them is that they are on home soil, and traditionally in the World Cricket League tournaments, the host team has always done extremely well. So having that home field advantage, you've got to make the most of it. But USA is a team that is used to playing Bermuda. There's a handful of guys who've got a decent amount of experience playing in Bermuda. at the top of the list, Sushil Nadkarni and Steve Messiah. And Muhammad Ghass was a key performer there a couple years ago, as well as Tim Roy Allen back in 2010. And when they won the 2020, the first ever America's 2020 tournament. And, you know, Nepal, it'd be interesting to see how Nepal performs in those conditions. But Nepal and Italy are two very good teams, and I think, you know, Bermuda could be in some serious trouble. And you asked about how did the USA players do, who stuck out for the USA. You know, Rashard Marshall came back into the team for this, for the 50-over matches, and hadn't played for the USA since the disastrous tour in Hong Kong back in 2011 for the previous Division III tournament, and he came in, and the only time he batted in the first match and scored a half century, and that secured his spot for the tour to Bermuda. And then in the third game, you had Barrington Barley come in, and in the last 20 overs scored an incredible century, 111 not out off 65 balls, and he was, he's been somebody who's kind of worked around the national scene for 7 or 8 years now. He was part of the USA squad the last time they played in the ITT Trophy in 2005. And then he played in the West Indies Cricket Cup for the USA in the three matches they played there in 2008, but hasn't represented the USA since then. And I think it's something that has puzzled a lot of people, because in a lot of the regional tournaments and many of the kind of league-based 2020 tournaments that these Premier League 2020 tournaments that have been popping up the last few years around the U.S., Barrington Barley's been one of the top performers consistently, and for whatever reason he was not being given an opportunity at the national level. And he's always been an excellent fielder. He's got a lot of energy in the field, bowl left arm spin, and batting-wise, I mean, he can be electric. And he certainly showed that in the third match against Bermuda. It was the only match he got an opportunity to bat. And he was pretty efficient in the 2020 matches as well. He'd come in late. He rarely ate up dot balls. I mean, if he wasn't hitting boundaries, he was at least turning the strike. And he's always busy at the crease. So he's somebody who's, I suppose, you could say he's new to the squad in terms of the last few years. But he has played for the U.S. before, and he'll be a plus for the team. And then, of course, Muhammad Ghass is a spin bowler who's been a tremendous line for them since he made his senior team debut in 2010, out of the 2010-19 World Cup as a spin bowler. He took 6 wickets in 2 games. And, you know, again, I mentioned before his presence with the third game when USA lost, so he's a key player, again, for the U.S. going to Bermuda. But for people who may have read one of the columns I wrote during the week, there are a few interesting collection decisions that were, I'm not entirely sure this is the best net pay ascending for what's an extremely crucial tournament in a lot of ways.
Yeah, let's go into that without maybe the same depth. Everyone should go and read Peter's article on Dream Cricket about this selection issues, because it was very comprehensive, and he's putting his reputation on the line on their team selection to an extent by having to go at the selectors. There were three players that I guess you were certainly a surprise, and I'm probably surprised as well, which is Thiagarajan, Suja, and Corns, that were not selected. Has there been any reasons given at all?
No. I as I put in the article, I tried to reach out to the chief selector and got no response, which is not entirely surprising for USACA, but it was a head scratcher in a lot of ways, for especially Aditya and Usman. You know, Aditya Thiagarajan has, since he came into the national team in 2008, he's been somebody who has always been somebody who has dug out of crisis situations, or, you know, if everybody's collapsing all around him, he's the only guy with a level head at the crease who doesn't buckle under the pressure. And those kind of guys are hard to find. And he might not have always stood out as somebody who's a flashy player. I mean, if you watched him at the crease, he wasn't very flamboyant. He was not somebody who, you know, for example, if you compare him to Barrington Barley, Barrington Barley, he's hitting fours and sixes all over the ground, and everybody's jumping up and down and excited to see Barrington Barley get to his century. But I think in the context of that match, Aditya's innings of 47 off of either 75 or 85 balls, whatever it was, 79 balls, something like that. I mean, he set the platform, and he allowed Bartley to play with the freedom that he did in the last 10 to 15 overs. And, you know, he was, say, from, you know, 45 for 3, and by the time he left, you know, they were I think 133 for 5 in the 36th over, and put on a hat partnership with somebody who was USA first time, Josh Jascombe. And that was something that was typical of him. He's a partnership builder. You look through the last couple of years, some of the best partnerships, the most significant partnerships in key match situations, Aditya Tyagarajan is always part of it. His personal score might not have been entirely significant. He might, you know, he did have two centuries, and he had four half centuries in the last, you know, since 2008, which, considering that the USA doesn't play a lot of games, is pretty impressive. I mean, he's only had 29 innings, so in the last maybe 22 or 23 innings, it would have been, it was when he scored his two centuries and four half centuries. But some of the situations he came into in 2008, USA was in a pretty bad spot against Canada in the Americas tournament, and he put together this very significant partnership with Orlando Baker. I think they put on 100 runs for the sixth wicket or the seventh wicket. It took USA from, I think they were 101 for 5 at that point in time, somewhere around there, and they were able to get them above 200, and then that was enough to defend. Orlando Baker took 5 wickets in the second innings, and I believe Aditya in that match finished 84 or 85 not out. You had in Division 5 in Jersey, they were in a huge pressure situation against Division 5 in Nepal, like against Jersey. They were playing Jersey. This is a team that KO'd USA from advancing out of the last Division 5 tournament, so there was a little bit of history there, a little pressure on the USA, and in a pretty dicey situation, he came together with Carl Wright, put together, again, I believe it was a century partnership, finished 84, 85 not out. Carl Wright wound up winning the Man of the Match award, because Carl Wright was, you know, hitting fours and sixes at the end of the innings, but it was really Aditya who again provided that spine to allow Carl Wright to shine at the end of the innings, and USA went on to win that match. And then you go a couple days later against Nepal in that famous match in the last round robin match of Division 5, and USA in a tricky chase on some pitches that were not easy to bat on. They only, you know, needed to get 160 or 162 to win, and he comes in and they're one, I think 112 for 5, and the ball crowd is going berserk, and he was able to bat with Sushil to the end, and he scored, I think, 18 or 20 that day, finished 20 not out. But just being able to stay in the crease and build partnerships is what he's all about. He has put in the article Ireland earlier on that tour against Ireland at the World 2020 qualifier. You know, USA was about to become a gigantic laughingstock, and they were 11 for 5, and he comes in and scored 72 not out against Ireland, and at least gave USA some dignity in that match, and aside from that, still left open the possibility that they could qualify going into that final match of the group stage against Afghanistan, and that's a match I think USA should have won if DT had batted higher that day. He came in at number 7 again instead of being promoted up the order. And USA only needed to face 130 odd, and they couldn't do it. And Steph Gannon, that was a winnable match. He was always the guy they could count on in these situations to get them out of trouble, and people always granted. And then, you know, when he got injured in Hong Kong in Division 3, you know, the balance of the team was just disrupted so severely. I mean, it was only one player. All right, one player gets injured. You still got Sushil Nadkarni, you still got Carl Wright, you still got Steve Messiah, all these other guys. Runs. But they were, it was like they had, the head had been set from that team. They go out the first match after losing Thiagarajan to a knee injury for the tournament, and they get bowled out 44 by Papua New Guinea. And they messed up a very simple chase against Oman. Fourth match. And you know, then they, in the last day, they couldn't come up with enough fight to beat Italy, and they wound up being relegated. And that just showed his value to the team. And he comes back in Malaysia. He might not have scored a lot of runs in Malaysia, but again, in that crucial time against Singapore, he comes out. He scored, I think, 20 or 22 runs. It was the partnership he built with Tim Royale. USA was 5 down for not much, and he put on a 70-run stand with Tim Roy Allen that took USA to a defendable total to help them win that match and secure promotion back into Division 3. And these are kind of some of the little things, subtle things, that I don't know if they if you're not at the ground and you're just looking at scorecards, you could say, oh, well, he only scored 22, and what the hell, why is that significant? You know, why is that such a big deal? It was the calmness and just his presence out there, being with the team, make the whole team just a lot more comfortable and at ease in what to do. And losing that is a significant blow to the team. And all you have to do is look at what happened in Hong Kong when he went down. And it just totally, like I said, disrupted the balance of the team. And then you look at Usman Khuja. And, again, he's been a very consistent performer. He's been somebody who's kind of been a spearhead of the attack, the fast bowling attack, and the last couple of tournaments, he might not have taken as many wickets as he had in the past, but part of that could be put down to USA's horrendous fielding in the match against Paul in Malaysia. I mean, that was one of the worst field performances I've ever seen, and he was hurt more than anybody in that match by USA's fielding. And fielding stats in terms of drops and misfields and those kind of things are not really documented terribly well in the cricket community. And I've tried to do my part a little bit in terms of providing some sort of measurable and in match commentary to kind of highlight the significance of and the impact that fielding can have, and bad fielding in particular. Khuja is somebody who's suffered teammates in that regard in terms of the fielding. And I don't know if that was necessarily taken into account when it came to, I know it didn't take too many wickets in the 350 over matches, the trial matches against Bermuda, but he wasn't at full strength. He'd been sick coming into the tournament. And look at the person who placed him. Nasir Jamali is a young, promising, up-and-coming talent. He's not a bad player. He played for the USA at the 19 World Cup in 2010, and he did the Audi Cup in November. But if you look at his, I think he took 2 for 105 in if it was 20 or 21 overs, he bowled in the series. And Khuja finished with 2 for 85. And I don't know how could it, you know, when you have two comparable sets of performances like that. I mean, it wasn't like Jamali took 8 wickets or 10 wickets for 105. He took 2 wickets for 105. And there's huge stats with the amount of experience he has and his pedigree. I don't know if that kind of performance from his player was enough to knock out, again, a senior established player in the team.
You mentioned briefly Josh Descombe. He won't be in Bermuda because he's not eligible, I believe, but he was a player that's been brought across from Australia because he holds a US passport. Are there other players like that on the horizon that US is likely to look at? Do you know of?
off the top of my head, I've only been curious last couple of years, Ehud Mubarak would ever answer the phone if USAC ever gave a call. He was born in Washington, D.C. He played for Sri Lanka. I believe he represented 2009 ICC World 2020 in England. And I know it's not something I'm entirely in favor of. There's Kama. I came to be aware of another player who was born in Texas. He was born in Dallas. Guy Penford, who I believe played in the Zimbabwe structure, and he scored a list day sent years ago. He's American-born, so I would imagine he has a U.S. passport. To ask him all when the notice was put out by the CEO, he's American-born. He's not eligible for this tournament, but he would be eligible for the ICC World 2020 qualifier, and he would be eligible for the ICC qualifier, well, for World Cup events, or World Cup qualifier, and not below that structure. Italy has that issue with their team heading into World Cricket 3 tournament. There's a couple guys who can't represent them, but would be able to if they advance the World 2020 qualifier, the World Cup qualifier in New Zealand. And Josh fits in that category as well. But, yeah, it would be, I don't know if there's other guys out there.
There's a guy who plays for Buckinghamshire in minor counties cricket in England, who was born in Minnesota, a guy called George Harper, only 25. Played a couple of first-class games at Durham University a few years back. So I assume he'd have an American passport as well, being born in Minnesota. But it's actually something that the U.S. Rugby team have done quite well in recent years.
Right. I mean, Andrew brings up an example like that. So there are players out there, players you wouldn't know exist. I mean, you know, and it's just a matter of the awareness. It's brought up, you know, if Andrew knows about it, and other people out there must know about it, so there are U.S. born players or U.S. citizens potentially playing in overseas destinations that, you know, could be eligible, and we'll see what happens over the next couple of years, how much of a commitment USA wants to show to that strategy versus developing players like Stephen Taylor locally.
So, move on to the World Cricket League 3. This is a tournament that it's in Bermuda, as we mentioned. There's six teams. It's the last stage before the World Cup qualifiers. On the plus side, every team except Italy has actually played relatively recently, so we can get a bit of an idea of where they're sitting based on their regional performances. Nepal's just come out of the Asian Cricket Championships trophy. They came second to Afghanistan. They actually lost to both Afghanistan and Hong Kong, but beat the UAE. But they had a pretty good week, really. They were strong and competitive throughout. Uganda came second to Kenya, but they beat them in one of their games in the African tournament recently. Oman had a very poor tournament in the Asian division, and I think ended up fourth in the group behind Kuwait. And Italy hasn't played at all, so who knows where they're at. They're also unlikely to have the players that they had in the World 2020 qualifiers. Where are we assessing their strength? Peter, you've probably seen them more than most people, those teams. Nepal and Italy and USA are the most likely teams to go up.
Like I said before, I think it's going to be a three-dog fight between those teams, USA, Nepal, and Italy, for the top two spots. Italy has their top-to-bottom depth is not as strong as USA or Nepal, but they do have a couple of very key players who, if they do fire, they would definitely provide enough to put Italy on top on a one-to-one basis. You know, a player like Peter Petracola, some of these guys, yeah, they're not playing, they haven't had the opportunity to play in an ICC Europe competition. I believe that's coming up in July. But, some of the players like Petracola belongs to Melbourne Cricket Club, so he's playing a pretty high standard of grade cricket in Australia. And, you know, he
has some good facilities at its disposal and a pretty decent standard of competition down there that would have kept him fit throughout the Northern Hemisphere winter. So if he's been playing cricket from September, October, all the way through the last week in March, whenever the grade finals, district finals would have been in Melbourne, and he should be coming into this tournament relatively fit, and if he's had some decent form, then he should be bringing that along with him. You know, players like Andy Northcote, Vince Panazza, I believe they play locally in South Africa. They play in the club competitions there. Damian Crowley is another pretty decent player. Carl Sandry joined the team in the 2020 qualifier. I believe he plays in Australia locally at the grade level. So that's kind of where the strength of the team lies in that regard. But they also have some players who play their local cricket in Italy, who are mainly of Sri Lankan heritage. I'm not sure how the Sri Lankan immigration came to Italy, but you have players like Gayajan Munasinghe, Dylan Fernando, who are pretty good raw young talents. They've got some pretty decent young pace bowlers in the team of Sri Lankan heritage, and they're a team that on paper you wouldn't think much of them, but they have a decent amount of chemistry playing together, and they can come up and surprise some people. But I think definitely the favorite going into the tournament would have to be Nepal, judging by the way they played against the USA in Division 4 and everybody else they played in that tournament in Malaysia, and seeing what they've done in on home soil recently in the Asian Cup. I think, the big problem with their bowling attack has always been fine. They've got, some of the best spinners in associate cricket, and that's never been a problem. The problem has always been the batting. Are they able to score enough runs to compete and hold off opponents? And, that was their issue in the final, essentially, against Afghanistan. They didn't have enough runs on the board. They put up 130, 133, whatever it was, they should have done better than that. Yeah, you look at a player like Parag Khadka, he's a fantastic player, and Janendra Mala have been basically the core of that team over the last 5-6 years, came through the under-19 program. They've been, Paris was given the captaincy fairly early on in his senior team career. He's been given a chance to groom into that role. He's an exciting captain on the field. I mean, he sets some pretty aggressive fields, and he's always changing fields and trying different things to keep the opposition on their toes. He doesn't let the opposition settle, and he'll rotate his bowlers constantly. I mean, he'll if you look at Shakti Gauchan or Pasan Regmi and they're bowling left arm spin. He'll have them bowl two overs, then he'll take them on, bring somebody on for one over, have them switch ends for one over, bring somebody else on for one over. You'll have, I think there was a match in Malaysia where he had 10 or 11 overs in a row of a different bowler bowling. Nobody bowled the same over from each end, two overs in a row. And it just keeps the other team off balance, and they don't get a chance to settle. And his bowlers are good enough where they don't get bothered by it. They don't get distracted. It doesn't break their rhythm. It's not like they're bowling wides or bowling full tosses or half trackers because they're not able to bowl five overs in a row. I mean, they're disciplined enough where when he gives them the ball, no matter what or when, they're able to put it right on the spot and challenge the batsman. And see, you have those spinners in that team to make them really sharp in the field. They've got a lot of energy in the field. Their catching is fantastic. They're always flying around the field, saving runs. I mean, matches they played against the USA the last couple of years, they've always saved 20 runs to 25 runs in the field, whether it's on the ground or catching-wise, whereas the USA has given up 20 to 25 runs in the field, whether it's catching or misfields or overthrows or whatnot. But the one thing that's held them back has been batting. But now you have somebody like Subhash Kakarel, who has emerged as a wicketkeeper batsman, and then you have Pradeep Airy as well, came through the under-19s in the last under-19 cycle, and they have taken that pressure off of Khadka and Mala to always perform. It was always if Kaká and Ala didn't score runs, Nepal always had a much more difficult chance to win the match. Now that he's got those two guys, have some extra support, they're not dependent upon to score runs every single match. There's not that massive amount of pressure on them to always perform with the bat. You have some other guys stepping up, emerging with the bat. That bodes well for Nepal, both in this tournament coming up and in the long term.
Quite noticeable in that tournament that Kaká was coming in down the order and really just holding together their late order chases and so forth. He wasn't coming in. If you went back 2 years ago to the Asian tournament, they were bowled out for about 70 against Afghanistan. And he was the only one who was able to do anything. Whereas now he's coming in when they're three for 60 or 70 and then kind of controlling their chases and controlling their lower order, which is, gives them a sense that they are controlling the game. That was the impression I got with watching them at the Asian Championship.
You know, it allows somebody like him or Mala to play with a little bit more freedom. I mean, Mala is a very exciting batsman. I mean, he's somebody who, once he gets set, he'll pull out the reverse sweep and he'll pull out, he'll get creative at the crease. He'll walk across his crease. He'll walk back and forth. He'll kind of toy with the bowlers. And, you know, when it was just him and Kaká who were the run scorers, he couldn't be as creative or be as dynamic as he wanted to be. But you look at his strike rate in the last couple of tournaments. I mean, he used to be somebody who had a strike rate kind of in the 60s or 70s just because he had to stay at the crease. And in the last couple of tournaments, I mean, he's scoring at whether it's 20 or 50 over cricket. I mean, he's going at, you know, if not a run a ball, better than a run a ball. And, he's just had a lot more freedom to play with. And I think you could say the same thing about Kaká as well in terms of, the shot selection that he's been able to enhance his range of strokes. He hasn't had to just kind of block and leave and make sure he's out there until the 45th over. So just because everybody else isn't strong enough around him to be able to sustain the innings for that long, if he's getting that support instead of coming in when the score is 2 for 20, he's coming in when it's 3 for 60. Obviously, he's gonna be able to have a lot more options at his disposal in terms of the freedom he's
with. With the venues, it's likely to be high scoring and quite small grounds. Will that suit any team in particular?
Well, you know, going into the Division III tournament in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, you would have said those grounds would have suited the U.S. because those were all tiny grounds. And you'd say, oh, the U.S. has got Carl Wright, they've got Lennox Cush, they've got Ned Carney. USA has got all these big hitters who can hit sixes. I mean, there was one or two grounds in Hong Kong where the Kowloon ground, for example, you've got one boundary, the kind of diagonal boundary over it off where the boundary is, I think, 35 yards or 40 yards. And everybody's just licking their chops. And then there was, you know, another ground, I would think, Hong Kong Cricket Club, where, you know, one of the boundaries, again, is, you know, 45 yards straight down the ground, and everybody got carried away thinking they could hit everything for six, and that's how you wound up getting bowled and LBW just slogging across the line. And I think USA, again, going into that tournament, I remember Clayton Lambert saying, oh, you know, we're going to score 300 every match. This is going to be, you know, our players are going to feast on these grounds, and these grounds are well suited to our big hitters. And there was not a single score for any of the teams that entire week that was above 300. And so playing on small grounds, it can be a bit deceptive in some regard. And the stadium ground, Hamilton, I think that's a regulation. That's a pretty big, with 75, 80 yard boundaries. But the other two grounds that they're using, as far as I know, they're pretty small. So it would be interesting to see how the teams adapt. You'd think, at face value, on paper, that would suit USA more than any of the other teams. But saw what happened in Hong Kong, where it kind of blew up in their faces. They got kind of overconfident. They got a little bit arrogant, carried away, and it didn't come off of them on those grounds, in those small boundaries. So be interesting to see what happens this week. You know, we know in the past the U.S. team has put up some massive scores within the Americas playing in Bermuda. Sacha Nadkarni in the last 50 over America's tournament in 2010 scored the fastest century on record for USA, 101 not out off 54 balls against Cayman Islands. The USA chased 129 in 11 or 12 overs, with him at the crease. And, you know, when Thiago Rajan was in the team a couple years ago for that same tournament against Argentina, he scored 159. The USA posted a total of 350, 360 out, and I think his 159, I want to say he entered in the 25th or 30th over, somewhere around there, and scored 159 off about 110, 111 balls. So there is the opportunity there to have players score at a pretty brisk pace, especially late in the innings. I mean, somebody like Barrington Bartley, seeing what he did at the stadium in Florida, coming in the last 20 overs and scoring a century inside the last 20 overs. If he is used in that scenario, Bermuda, in this tournament where he comes in at 6 or 7 with 10 or 15 overs to go, I mean, he's somebody who could be very explosive. Same thing with Tim Roy Allen coming in again in the late overs. But again, it's a matter of getting to that stage and going up against a team like Nepal. USA has been put under a lot of pressure. And, you know, USA's perhaps the biggest match of the tournament is that very first match. USA and Nepal are going head-to-head on the very first day of the tournament. And if, you know, whoever wins that match is going to be in the driver's seat for the rest of the way to finish in the two promotion spots. And if USA loses that match, I think it'll be very difficult for them to try and recover and get some momentum going, because again, there's no room for them to breathe the next day. On day two, they're playing Italy. So if they go into those two games, they lose against Nepal and they lose against Italy, then all of a sudden they need to win their last three games. They have, having done so, you know, with the losing momentum, that they would need to turn around. And then in addition to that, they would need some help. I mean, essentially they would need either Nepal or Italy to stumble, or, you know, and then whoever wins the Nepal Italy match later on in the tournament, you know, the loser of that game would need to stumble at some other point in the tournament. So that first match couldn't be more big. I mean, I think USA would have felt a lot more comfortable if they had been able to play Oman or Uganda or even Bermuda, especially in the first match or the first couple matches, just to be able to establish a level of comfort, build up some chemistry with some of the new players in the squad, so people could establish their roles a little bit more. They don't have that opportunity in this tournament, like they might have been able to in past tournaments. And, you know, if they win that first match, then I think, it would be a tremendous confidence boost. And then you could, like I said, put USA in the driver's seat to finish in the top two spot. But, if they don't win that first game against Nepal, it's going to be a massive, massive contest. And, it could be a very difficult, it would be a big, big hill for them to climb with the rest of the tournament.
Let's switch tack a little. I wanted to ask you about the US Osaka's administration, and what's the latest on their legal issues with their former secretary that you know of?
That's a good question. a lot of stuff that gets put out on Twitter or certain places on the internet, it just comes from one source, and that's one of the interested parties in the matter. So it's always hard to gauge how much stock do some of the information that's coming out. But there is still the ongoing matter with Kevin Williams and USAC as he tries to kind of clear his name for when he was dismissed as executive secretary, trying to establish whether or not it was actually done through due process. You've got the NACL case with USAC. It's kind of they were the group that was kind of spurned, I guess, in this whole CHALC initiative. That was supposed to be them. NACL was supposed to be the kind of the party that's having the 2020 rights and the responsibility to organize that, at least from the NACL's perspective. They feel like they were not treated properly and fairly in the process in terms of establishing that tender that eventually became CHALLC. So there's that going on, and obviously the whole mess that took place with the leagues being disenfranchised, and now American Cricket Federation, what they're doing and what they're up to in terms of posing a challenge to USACA. So yeah, there's never a dull day in U.S. cricket, as I'm sure you guys well know.
And into that, you've got a brand new CEO who's obviously someone who likes the challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what you said verbatim when I, another interview that's yet to be published, I was in Florida, but I did another interview with the CEO. He basically said, yeah, and I asked, why did you honestly take this job? He said, I know how to read. I was going through the application process. I wasn't blind. It was all out there on the internet. You couldn't. I was aware of it. So I'm not going to pretend like it. I didn't know about it. But he said, hey, I've always been somebody who likes a challenge, and I thought this was a fantastic opportunity to demonstrate what I've done before with the Aussie rules in South Africa and what I've done with sailing in Australia. And I thought, whatever he said, this is the next progression in that challenge, taking on a challenge for him and his career. But it's a different kettle of fish than Aussie rules or sailing. I'm sure at least when you entered those roles, there was some semblance of organization and cohesion within the other structure that he didn't have to worry about, and that's not necessarily the case with Micah. And he's big ahead of him. He's got a lot of work cut out for him, but I think he's a pretty sharp guy. My initial interactions with him, I'm optimistic that he is somebody who will hopefully correct some of the things that have been long-standing issues in terms of development and also just general structure and organizational problems with USACA that those are some of the things that will really need to change in order for USACA to get out of limbo and progress into something resembling an actual proper governing. And if he can do that, I mean, he'll be the savior of U.S. cricket, I guess you could say. But it's a massive uphill task. We'll see what happens. But when you come into the job at the stage that he's come into after some of the things that happened over the last year, I mean, USACA, if they weren't at rock bottom, they were pretty damn close to it. I mean, they weren't suspended by the IOC, so I guess you could say that would have been rock bottom in 2005 or 2007 when they threw those suspensions. But pretty dire situation that he walked into. So from that standpoint, take place for him to go up the bar low in terms of what's ahead of you. So if he's able to really make things happen, I think people will be very, very they'll rally behind him.
Should wrap this show up then, I think. There's a bit of news going on. There's a few things starting this week. The World Cricket League 7, I think, begins in about an hour or so. You can tell because if you go to the ICC website, there's a giant banner that says nothing at all about it on any news articles or anywhere else.
They put out a press release about the Champions Trophy yesterday. It said that the Champions Trophy was the only nation-v-nation cricket tournament in 2013. I'm sure many other countries will have something to say about that.
It's where we're at with the governing body, unfortunately. The one we were watching on dodgy streaming sites last week was the Asian Cricket Council's T20. We'll have a chat about this next week, hopefully. But to summarise what happened, Hong Kong qualified out of Group A, along with Nepal. Hong Kong won their group, very dominant performance through the first three or four games. But lost to Afghanistan in the semi. In Group B, Afghanistan and the UAE, who had already qualified, came through, and UAE won against Afghanistan, which would be an upset if it didn't happen every single time they play. But they lost their semi to Nepal, as we've discussed earlier. Afghanistan won the final by 7 wickets in front of a crowd that was estimated at something between 20 and 27,000, which was extremely impressive and extremely well behaved. And finally, just to wrap that tournament up, the Singapore and Bahrain were relegated. A little bit of a surprise to Singapore. Andrew, any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think exactly what you said. That crowd figure, I've seen another estimate of 35,000. It seems to go up every time it's reported. So I suspect the real figure is probably more around the 20,000 figure. And well behaved. I'm sure Peter can tell us about the time he had in Nepal a few years ago.
You know, I think 27,000 is a bit of a stretch in terms of whatever the estimate was, but I realistically, looking at the crowds on TV, I definitely 20,000 is definitely a rank and realistic figure, which regardless, 5,000 would have been impressive for an associate match. I mean, and to see that much support for a team that, again, is in Division 3 at the moment in the World Cricket League structure, I mean, it's something that is fantastic to see, and you wish there would be more done to promote that and really emphasize the fact that, hey, people do care. When you see empty grounds in the West Indies and you see empty grounds in South Africa or Australia for certain matches and even to a certain extent India and Sri Lanka, and then you see what happens in Nepal with what I think many people would sneer at and look down upon as two, you know, quote-unquote inferior teams, having 27,000, whether it's 20,000 or 27,000 or anything in between, that should be celebrated and not, just ignored.
In other news, there's been announced a fixture between a combined associate 11 against India in June. I have mixed feelings about this. Andrew, your thoughts?
It's always good to see associate nations playing against full members. But with it being a combined side, it sort of puts India in a no-lose situation. If they were to lose the match, you can say, well, we're playing against a combined side. Of course, they're going to be able to beat us. And if they win the match, then it's, well, look, even a combined associate side isn't good enough to beat us. How can just one be talented enough to play at the highest level? So there's mixed feelings about that, and whether players will be available for it as well. You know, Ireland will have their county players unavailable, and I think it coincides with one of their interprovincial matches as well. The Netherlands will have played South Africa just the day before, so maybe the Netherlands players might not be available as well. So it might not be a full strength side. I'd rather see India actually play one of the associate sides like Pakistan and South Africa doing in the build up to the Champions Trophy.
Peter, any thoughts or?
Yeah, I mean, it's a double edged sword. You'd like to see players get opportunities and get chances to get exposure at the associate level in that regard, but you'd much prefer, like Andrew said, to see a full-strength, complete national team get a chance to go on the field. I mean, there was whatever comment was made recently by Dave Richardson that he feels apparently that Ireland's not ready for test level. Well, let them prove that on the field. Give them that opportunity. Why is that being decided in a boardroom? Let Ireland demonstrate on the field whether or not they're worthy of being able to play a 4-day or a 5-day match against Australia or India or whatever. We'll never know unless they're given that chance. So why not arrange a full strength single country match against India like as Andrew's demonstrated, Pakistan is doing.
In some ways it would actually be better, this match, if it wasn't the best players available, because it would allow you to select some of the players who haven't had an opportunity to play against the best nations who in those lower divisions who we've talked about today, Parth Kopra, Stephen Taylor, some of the Hong Kong players, to give them an opportunity and to demonstrate that actually not only is associate cricket strong in places like Ireland, but actually there's a lot of good players right down through the divisions I think I'd probably prefer to see that than just an all-star side. And finally, there's a tour coming up between the Netherlands and Namibia, in Namibia, which we need to preview. Start with the I-Cup match. Namibia is currently on 43 points and the Netherlands 30. Both have a chance to go third if they take the full points from the match and remain in contention. It's pretty much a must-win for the Netherlands. I'm not sure. I haven't seen any squads yet, though, Andrew. Do you know whether they'll be at full strength or they have big Spanish players as well?
The Netherlands don't know. Ryan Tenderscarter is also busy in the IPL, and Alexi Kaversi. There are rumours that he has retired from Dutch international duty. I'm not sure how accurate they are. But he would obviously be playing county cricket anyway, so probably wouldn't have been available. So the Netherlands are at full strength. And as an aside, I know that this is listed on the ICC website as a test match, as the last month's Intercontinental Cup games were for a while. That's something we've talked about in the past. So, and Namibia have struggled in the South African amateur three-day competition this year, not done very well. They were playing quite well against Western Province, but it looks like that game's heading for a draw now. Western Province have put up a big score in their first innings, and there's only one day left. So, I think it's as you say, it's a must-win game for Namibia. It's a must-win game for the Netherlands as well. And I think these teams are quite evenly matched, especially with the Netherlands missing their two best players.
And the WCL Championship games, Namibia is currently on 4 points. It looked like they were a long way behind, but if they win both, they'll only be 2 points behind second. Netherlands is currently on 10 points. They have a chance to go second if they win both games. Again, intriguing matches. Probably Namibia's strength, given their strong batting.
They've got a couple of players who, if they play to the top of their abilities, can take the game away from the team. So these matches, again, I think Namibia probably have more chance of winning this game than they do the four-day game.
Peter, any thoughts on...
Yeah, from the little few times I have seen Namibia, they strike me as a side that, again, their strength is the batting. They're never going to be a side that's going to really win matches with the bowling. So it's a matter of, can they put up a big toll? Can they put up 250, 300 against Netherlands? You look at Craig Williams and Jerry Sneeman and some of the other players in their team, and if they can post up a big total, it's just a matter of just outlasting Netherlands in that regard. That's their best chance of winning. They're not gonna defend a small total, so they need to really put up a big score and then hope they can just restrict and keep Netherlands from chasing. I'm not sure what effect not having Kaversi around will mean, because to be honest, I've never, even the times he has played for Holland, he's never been a significant contributor as far as I know. I mean, somebody like Tom Cooper is a much bigger asset to the Netherlands lineup than say Kaversi has been. He came with a lot of hype when he first came into the Netherlands team, and if he's retiring, I'm not sure how much that would actually hurt Netherlands, to be honest. But I think it's unfortunate. I think he'd be missing out chances for himself to develop. That's his decision, if indeed that is what it is.
And finally, we won't make any predictions, but it's good to see there's been announced a T20 quadrangular between Kenya, Namibia, the Netherlands, and South Africa A side immediately following those games. So a little bit of practice. So Kenya and Namibia, I think, is the great T20 rivalry. They must have played more than a dozen times now. But a good sign to see South Africa A sending a squad across to some practice.
Always good to see. As I said earlier, full members sending sides to associate countries, even if it is just an A side. So hopefully it will test Namibia, Kenya and the Netherlands at a slightly higher level than they otherwise used to.
And with that, we'll catch you next week.